You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the internet can seem disconnected from the real world. You log in, you log out. But what kind of long-term effects does this have on our culture? Are the memes we're laughing at more meaningful than we realize? We'll tackle those questions with the creator of a new online series called Internetting. First, in a series of New Year's Day tweets, President Trump said that the United States has, quote, foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the last 15 years, end quote. He went on to say that the only thing the U.S. has gotten in return were, again quoting, nothing but lies and deceit. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley backed up the president's comments and accused the country of harboring terrorists. The tweets sent by the president caused protests in large Pakistani cities. Now the White House is saying we're going to cut a lot of military aid to Pakistan. Saeed Khan is with us now. He's a senior lecturer in Near East Asian and Global Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back, Rob.
Well, the core argument from President Trump and the White House is that Pakistan has been backing the Taliban in some ways in their own country and in Afghanistan. And they're right, right? This is kind of an open secret, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I think it's a much more complicated situation when one takes a look at two things. First, the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan is quite porous. And in many ways, not only does that inform the mobility and the movement of the Taliban back and forth, with limited resources on the part of Pakistan to be able to really police or control that, but it also shows the rather porous nature of how the Taliban is perceived, both by the United States and by Pakistan. Here you have a situation where the Taliban is certainly a major player in Afghan politics, and it would be very difficult for any kind of long-term strategic perspective on the part of the United States to not involve the Taliban in some capacity or the other. Pakistan also recognizes this and is, of course, also concerned with its own domestic stability and security, something that the Taliban wields an awful lot of influence in determining within its borders.
So that said, what is your reaction to, first, the president's tweets and to this idea of a major cut in military aid to Pakistan?
Well, first of all, I think that when you take a look, Rob, at the president's tweets and what seems to be a rather mercurial attitude toward Pakistan, this is something that is not new. We saw that even in 2007, then-candidate Barack Obama had some rather critical positions to take regarding Pakistan, but once he was in office, he had to concede to the realpolitik and to broader American foreign policy strategic considerations. That being said, it's also important to recognize that Pakistan has been a frontline ally of the United States, particularly during the Cold War. It was the only non-Western country to belong to more than one defense configuration, the Central Nations Treaty Organization, as well as the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. This is a country from which covert ops were launched, the infamous 1960 Gary Powers U-2 incident, a country which also was a major conduit in the battle to end the Cold War with the Afghan War that lasted from 1979 to 1989, and then, of course, from 2001 onwards, the battle against al-Qaeda. So when President Trump is saying that this is going to be a new relationship and a punitive one toward Pakistan, number one is it seems to belie a much longer history, which is certainly a rather turbulent marriage, if you will. But also the amount of money that is being dangled as a threat to Pakistan is really pittance. We're talking about $255 million. At the same time, Pakistan's investment, thanks to China, is on the total of about $62 billion. So you're talking about a 243 times investment that the regional superpower China has. What this will probably do is intensify already very good relations with China, and Pakistan is going to drift further away from the American sphere of influence.
Talking to Saeed Khan from Wayne State University, looking at the U.S. relationship with Pakistan after tweets from Donald Trump, critical of the country, and a threatened cutoff of some military aid. Saeed, with that history you just mentioned, is there going to be concern from Pakistani leadership about the United States? We were heavily involved there, as you were saying, during the Cold War and the last days of the Cold War. We kind of backed away and disappeared for a while until we needed them again after 9/11.
And that's something, Rob, that I think Pakistani leaders, and really what we're talking about is three different spheres of leadership here. We have the civilian leadership, we have the military, and then we have the all-powerful ISI, their intelligence services. We find that particularly when it comes to the military and the ISI, they have recognized that the United States, going all the way back really to 1989 and the end of the Afghan war, that American attention span, shall we say, may not necessarily be that focused. And perhaps that seems to be much more personified with President Trump and his attention span regarding regarding Pakistan. And so Pakistan has been very capable of then coming up with contingency plans, not only when it comes to its relationship with China, but also domestically. This certainly was one of the reasons why it went forward with its nuclear program in the 1980s, which culminated in 1998 with the test firing of a nuclear weapon, even though they realized that this would then subject them to sanctions, which it did, from the United States.
Looking at U.S. efforts in Afghanistan, how difficult is that for us to stay there in Afghanistan without Pakistani cooperation in terms of just using their borders to get troops and supplies in and out, among other things?
Well, Pakistan is the only country that has a border with Afghanistan for with which the United States has the least worst relations. On the western side, of course, is Iran. In the north, there is Russia or former Russian republics, and then, of course, China to the east. So in many ways, again, this is a marriage of both convenience and inconvenience at the same time. It seems as though cooler heads will have to prevail, and we see still, despite the rhetoric both from President Trump as well as UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, a movement toward perhaps something a bit more tepid. The thing that has really been noteworthy is how public this criticism has been, which of course then really suggests that the audience for this was not Pakistan and certainly the capital of Islamabad and the leadership there, but really trying to mollify some of the other regional players, particularly India, in efforts to create better economic and military cooperation with Pakistan's arch rival to the east.
Could this be seen as a tough negotiating tactic? We're sending this strong public message to the leadership in Pakistan that'll get them to come to the table and maybe work a little better with us in the future?
Well, I think that no one has actually left the table, Rob, and what we're probably going to see then is some kind of rhetorical gestures on the part of Pakistan to say that we will go ahead and take certain initiatives and certain measures. Perhaps there will be more identifiable benchmarks to say that with this kind of cooperation, with this kind of assistance, we can guarantee or we will move toward the minimization of cross-border terrorism and extremism taking part. But again, the audience for these rather inflammatory statements seems to be less about Pakistan than what is being perceived as a shift in American foreign policy in the region, both to perhaps contain China as well as to create a counterweight force with India.
You mentioned earlier, though, that this could push Pakistan closer to China. I've also seen people saying that it could push them closer to another ally with some question marks of the United States, Saudi Arabia.
Well, the relationship between Pakistan and Saudi Arabia is actually already quite strong. Saudi Arabia is not only the home of a lot of Pakistani expatriates for whom remunerations back to Pakistan forms a very vital part of their GDP. There's also an awful lot of foreign aid that Saudi Arabia gives to Pakistan and has done so for decades, as well as the fact that Saudi Arabia has been fighting a proxy war against its major nemesis, Iran, on Pakistani soil by fanning the flames of sectarian and communal violence there. Now, with the new attack taken by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a proxy to his father, the ailing King Salman, it's going to be interesting to see whether this kind of fomentation of sectarian violence will continue and whether the Saudis will underwrite that, or whether they will, in the estimation and the objectives of Mohammed bin Salman, try to scale back the support for religious extremism that Saudi Arabia has made as part of its hallmark foreign policy over the last 3.5 decades, which would then greatly impact Pakistan and perhaps move Pakistan beyond what right now is a rather immoderate ideological expression.
A lot to keep an eye on, Saeed. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Saeed Khan is a senior lecturer in Near East Asian and Global Studies at Wayne State University. He joined us to talk about President Trump's threat to withdraw military aid to Pakistan. First, there's so much out there on the internet. It's hard to talk about internet culture. Instead, there are a zillion different internet cultures, each with their own unique themes and languages, and it can be hard to keep track of it all. Our next guest is exploring some of those cultures and themes in a new online series that covers everything that's weird, wrong, and totally sad about internet culture. Amanda Hess is a David Carr Fellow at the New York Times and writes about internet culture. She produces a video series called Interneting with Amanda Hess. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as I start to think about it and watch your pieces, I realize, you know, I spend probably too much time on the internet, and yet there's probably 98% of what's out there that I have no idea what other people are doing or they're into.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly have the same experience. One of the videos that I made came from a tip that I got from a 12-year-old girl. So, you know, I too, like, I can't find all this stuff searching myself because I'm in my own little bubble as well.
Right, and even if we want to find different things, the internet, social media, filters, they give us the things that they think we want. So it's really, in some ways, hard to discover what maybe a different generation or different community is looking at.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how, you know, even the people who we consider to be celebrities in different micro-generations are turning out to be not only different people, but people who do, like, completely different things on different platforms. So it's really creating a sort of, like, not just, we talk a lot about the political divide that these filter bubbles create, but it also creates this very cultural divide between people from different countries, different parts of the country, and especially different age groups.
Yeah, we talked about that Logan Paul story earlier, the famous YouTuber, famous among a select community, and who? To a lot of other people.
Yeah, I'm somewhere in the middle between those two groups, I think.
So that takes us to interneting. What are you trying to do with this online series?
So I read about internet culture, or as you mentioned, internet cultures for the New York Times, and that means that I'm making a product that usually ends up in a newspaper, which is you know, a non-online format. I'm writing an essay that's like 1,000 words, and with the video series, what we're really trying to do is to bring, like, my insights and my analysis of the internet into a form that is, like, internet native itself. So analyze the internet with the images of the internet, in the language of the internet. And so I teamed up with our wonderful video team to start this series. It's called Interneting.
And I want to dig into one of the videos that I probably should have known more about the content, given that I'm a parent, but I didn't. Beauty apps, where people take their selfies, they can buy an app and change them in a zillion different ways. Can you talk about what people can do with their selfies?
Yeah, so this is the video that started out as a 12-year-old girl's idea. She's the daughter of a colleague, and she was taken aback when she found that an app that, again, this is very popular among young girls, but something that maybe adults have never heard of, called Musical.ly, where you lip sync to songs and post videos of them. All of a sudden, this new button appeared on the homepage that is a beauty filter. So with literally like the tap of a button, it basically gives you like a kind of photoshopped, like, facelift kind of thing. And she, you know, even at 12 years old, was disturbed by this idea because so easily and quickly, even though it's an option, that option changes the whole landscape of the expectations of how you're supposed to look on this app. So it's really spreading everywhere, but there are a bunch of different apps. Like, I downloaded maybe 20 when I was trying them out, and they're really, really popular in China, which says to me that, you know, more of them may be popular in the U.S. soon. And even though there are so many of them, there are some real trends that you can see in the types of appearances and aesthetics that are being engineered and programmed into the apps. So right. A lot of them try to make you look whiter. Most of them try to make you look thinner, definitely youthful, super feminine. So all of these beauty standards that we sort of know that society is transmitting to us in some way are being very, literally programmed into these apps.
Right. And we've heard people talk for years about how, you know, maybe a fashion magazine or a TV ad is creating these specific standards of beauty, standards that might be hard to meet for a lot of people, problematic in a lot of ways. How does it change things when people get to change, young girls in particular, are changing their own faces according to whatever this app's algorithm says is prettier?
Well, I think one thing that's different is when a magazine photoshops a celebrity, there's sort of a locus of responsibility that somebody can go to complain. So several years ago, I remember there were a bunch of campaigns, some of them, again, started by teenage girls, asking magazines to not Photoshop models and celebrities, and there were editors of these magazines who could be held to account for that. When this stuff is programmed into apps, you know, a lot of times when somebody's using Facebook or, Musical.ly or one of these Chinese beauty apps like Meitu, especially if they're a younger user or somebody who has never really thought about how the internet gets made, it seems almost like inevitable and natural that these things are happening. You don't sort of like know who's encoding these standards, even if you wanted to complain about them. So I think it definitely integrates them more seamlessly into our lives.
We're talking to Amanda Hess from the New York Times, a creator of the Internetting series, a video series at the New York Times. And Amanda, you write or say in this particular video that the internet and social media creates this rewards network. I put a thing up there, I'm rewarded based on the amount of attention I get. So there's, in the cases of these apps, an incentive for me to be as pretty or cool looking or whatever as I can to get those responses.
Yeah, that's one of the sort of, I think, more disquieting things to me is that, it's not just about looking your best or, you know, trying to feel good about yourself. It's about trying to get a response from your friends, which then sort of like encodes a standard for them. So with Musical.ly, you know, if one person starts using the beauty filter app, it feels like they have this sort of advantage or standard that is then re-encoded by everybody else. So it's really sort of like it's a different situation than when we can point to a fashion editor. We have to point towards all, you know, every million person who is doing this themselves. So it makes it a lot harder to tackle.
And we've been focusing on just one of a handful of internetting videos. I want to peek at another one in our last few minutes, one on political memes. And this is another case where if you've presented yourself as a Democrat on the internet, you probably saw a lot of positive Hillary Clinton memes, anti-Donald Trump memes. Flip things around, you saw a lot of pro-Donald Trump, anti-Hillary Clinton. You probably never saw the other category in a lot of cases. These are two different worlds.
Right, that's true. And, you know, I know it's been a long time since the campaign. I can't even imagine what we're going to be dealing with in 2020 and what sort of technology is going to be used for this stuff. But one of the things that I found really interesting, sort of revisiting those political memes from the campaign, is the way in which creating a meme about the candidate makes you almost feel like you are a part of their campaign, like you're like some sort of campaign volunteer or are like building their online persona yourself. So it's not just what Hillary Clinton's saying, but what your, the filter that you're putting on it after she says it to make her look stupid or to make her look like a glorious feminist goddess or whatever. And so that really like re-encodes people's feeling of investment and personal interaction with these politicians, even if it's a bit of a fantasy.
Well, is it maybe a good thing, though? There's a concern people are disengaged from politics, detached from it. If with this level of personal involvement, even if it's just making a meme, is there a positive there?
You could argue that there's a positive, but the theme of my video series is the internet is fundamentally, you know, a force for negativity. I think the negative thing that happens is that when, you know, obviously, you know, this is something that we've seen before the internet, but the internet sort of works in the same vein in similar ways, is that the candidates become, not people who are there to advocate for us and to hold to account, but instead these sort of like godlike character figures that we're constructing to say things that they really haven't said and represent things that they really don't represent. And I think there's something, you know, even if you can see the benefit of the participation, that there's something sort of fundamentally anti-democratic about that, that theme.
Big picture, if you weigh all the good and the bad of the internet, do you, Amanda, ultimately personally come out pessimistic about what the internet is doing to us?
A few years ago when I started writing about the internet, I was very Pollyanna-ish about it, and a lot of my pieces would be sort of highlighting the positive things about it, especially when people would sort of come out with, the scare tactic-y stories about it, and that sort of has developed into like more of a cynicism and a negativity in recent years. It might turn back the other way again, and maybe it's just that I'm getting older, but I also just find that, like, you know, there are really big, powerful companies that are behind these internet cultures that we all participate in, and they deserve to be, you know, scrutinized and held to account. So there's a reason for focusing on the negative, I think.
Is there agency? Do we, just in our last few moments, do we have the power to maybe tip the balance back?
I think that's more of a question for our legislators, actually. I mean, part of the problem is that there are these huge companies that, you know, Google and Facebook have, like, what is now sort of considered an ad duopoly on the internet. So I don't think we can do it ourselves, but through collective political action, possibly.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Amanda Hess is a David Carr Fellow at the New York Times writing about internet culture. She joined us to talk about her video series. It's called Interneting with Amanda Hess. Now, the political fight over DACA and immigration has been intense over the years, but especially since President Donald Trump took office. On Wednesday, a federal judge blocked Trump's plans to end the Obama-era program DACA that protects young people from deportation if they were brought to the country illegally as children. But the injunction is temporary, which means about 800,000 immigrants protected by DACA have an uncertain future. Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. He's a teacher and scholar of immigration and citizenship. He's also written a book called Immigration Outside the Law. He joins us for a closer look at the latest. Hiroshi, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's focus in on this court decision for a moment. What did we hear from this judge in San Francisco? What justification did he make for blocking this Trump administration effort?
Well, I mean, just to give you a brief overview of what he said that President Trump ordered a phase out of DACA. That was what he did last September, and then the judge this week in San Francisco, a federal district court judge, Judge Alsup, blocked a significant part of that rescission. I mean, it basically meant that instead of a phase out, which is what the president ordered, that people who have DACA now can continue to file for renewals. And so instead of having people lose status after the phase out period, in other words, start to lose status in March, people can continue to file renewal applications. All of this, and I think this is what you alluded to in the way you phrased the question, all this is temporary until the court can sort out all the arguments on a more permanent basis.
And where is this in the courts now? What kind of lawsuits are out there, and where are they in the system?
Well, there are two clusters of lawsuits we've got here. They're both at the district court level, in other words, the lowest level of federal courts. There's a cluster of lawsuits in California, in the Northern District of California, that's San Francisco, and Judge Alsup is presiding over that set of lawsuits. And this is the context of the decision this week. There's also a cluster of lawsuits pending in the Eastern District of New York, and those are brought by other groups, all these lawsuits try to block the ending of DACA, but there are different people involved, everything from companies to universities to individuals, nonprofit organizations, and a number of states have sued to keep DACA in place.
getting into the legal system and some of the intricacies. Those courts are making their way through the courts, the system. This judge has said, okay, injunction, we're going to keep DACA going until these work their way through the system. Can the Trump administration challenge that injunction itself separately from all those other cases?
Yes. And, I would be surprised if they don't challenge it in some way. My news feeds that appeal had not been filed. But what the administration, I think, can be expected to do is to say that this temporary blockage, or in other words, the temporary order that you must keep accepting DACA renewal applications, the federal government administration can be expected to appeal that order. And so in thinking about the order, there's one version of reality, which is, you can keep the DACA program alive according to the federal district court judge, but it's also possible a higher court will step in and say, no, you can't. We have to, go ahead with the rescission, all of which is until this thing can be sorted out in court, which is going to take some time.
What does this mean for an individual DACA recipient, someone who's brought here illegally but as a minor, someone who's covered by DACA? Where are they now?
Well, they're in a position of course, all this is individualized, and so this is just general information, but they're in a position now where the federal government is under a court order to accept their application to renew their DACA status if it's going to expire even after the March 5th phase-out date. So this really gives some hope to people who now have DACA that they'll be able to continue. One thing the judge did say, though, is that people who've never had DACA will not be able to apply for the first time. The judge was very focused on the harm to people who have DACA and to their employers and the colleges where they go, and so that but people who have DACA now, according to this particular court order, will be allowed to renew. Now, it turns out that last I looked earlier today, the government hasn't set up a procedure for actually taking the renewal applications, but you would think that they would have to do that because they're under court order to do that.
Hiroshi Motomura is with us from the UCLA School of Law. He's the author of Immigration Outside the Law, looking at some of the latest news on DACA and immigration. And Hiroshi, while this is going on, while we're talking, really, there are these negotiations going on in Congress with the White House over what to do with DACA, whether they can come up with some kind of compromise. It's complicated. There's they're weighing border security, a spending bill, wider immigration reform. It's changing by the minute in some cases. What are you watching for in that national debate?
Well, one of the things that I think your question highlights is that whatever happens with DACA, DACA is a temporary way to process or to manage immigration enforcement. It never was to give someone a permanent residence status. It was never to put them on a path to citizenship. And so I think it's fair to say that people on both sides of this debate think that the best solutions are the ones that come from Congress and are more long-lasting. And so, as you mentioned, on the negotiating table is not just a legislative version of DACA, often under the name of the DREAM Act, but there are other bargaining chips on the bargaining table. One is funding for border wall or the form of border security. Two other issues that are being debated now in Washington, D.C., are cutting back on legal immigration. In other words, making it harder to come, particularly based on family ties, and also ending the lottery, which allows about 50,000 people to come here based on a lottery, come from countries that have not sent many immigrants to the United States. All this is on the negotiating table, and the reason it's complicated in terms of the lawsuit and the order this week is that the order is a temporary order, and it doesn't really eliminate the need for Congress to look at this. And yet, there's a lot of back and forth and difference of opinion about. Some people, I think that the fact that the judge has ordered DACA to stay in place takes the pressure off Congress. Other people think, no, the pressure is just as much on, especially if the order is appealed and the order is held in abeyance.
We're talking to Hiroshi Motomura, professor of law and scholar of immigration and citizenship. We're looking at the latest on DACA, the program program that protects nearly 800,000 undocumented immigrants from deportation. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let us know if this story is affecting you or people close to you directly. And what do you want to see come out of Congress when it comes to DACA? Do you want a compromise that establishes some kind of permanent status for people who are brought into the country illegally as youth? Should that plan include a border security enhancement, a wall, literal or metaphorical, higher security? Do we need comprehensive immigration reform in this country? What does that look like to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Hiroshi Motomura. He's a professor of law and scholar of immigration and citizenship. We're talking about the future of DACA, the program that protects hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants from deportation. This is people who were brought over illegally as minors. Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. There are a lot of pieces of news about immigration out there right now, a lot of ideas on the table. What do you want to see? Do you want to see DACA resolved so that these people brought over as kids can stay in the country legally in the long term, get out of that gray area? Do you want to see more border security, a literal wall, or just enhanced security of one type or another? Should we create a path to citizenship for some of the millions of people here illegally? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Hiroshi, it's already complicated enough. I'm going to throw in another story out there. People here from El Salvador brought in under this temporary protected status after earthquakes there a bunch of years back. The Trump administration is saying, okay, things are back to normal enough in El Salvador. This temporary status can end. What are you seeing in that story?
Well, this is another one of the stories that's very big right now, as you mentioned. And you know, this has been a program that has not just been for El Salvador. It's been for other countries in Central America and other places that have had civil war, famine, environmental disaster. And so what the administration did was announce a phase out to this program for El Salvador. But this program has been around for some 15, 20 years. And it's another example, I think, of how the system hasn't been working very well. A lot of the people who have come from El Salvador actually have, I think, strong asylum claims. A lot of them also have family ties in this country. I think we're going to see a lot of the people who are having this temporary protected status and actually go through a normal petitioning process to get lawful status. I also think it's going to put a lot of pressure on the asylum system because people, as I said, many of people do have claims that they can bring. So I think it's also a big part of the status of immigration debate in this country right now. It's so many different moving parts. You know, we already talked about the wall, the diversity lottery, legal immigration, the status of DACA, the larger question of undocumented or illegal immigration, and asylum and temporary protected status is part of this too. So, I mean, this is what makes the complicated the negotiations so complicated. And it's not just Congress, but you've also got the courts coming in from time to time.
Given all that and given failed past efforts to tackle all of this, do you think it's likely that we're going to see some kind of comprehensive reform, or are we going to just keep on coming up with minor fixes here and there?
You know, that's really the million-dollar question here. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I guess the best answer I can give you is that if something happens that is a multi-piece legislative compromise, it would not surprise me. If nothing happens, that would also not surprise me. I think that no matter what happens, there'll be things that are left out. In other words, this is so complicated that if you, for example, have something like a DREAM Act to be a permanent or a stronger legislative solution for DACA, you might also see an increase in border funding, and then people who want to have something else could be part of the package may be disappointed. That's in the nature of things. This is, you know, we're in an extremely volatile and unpredictable time in the immigration debate, and I think that a lot of this needs to be worked out actually as much within the political parties as against each other. I think that one of the things we're seeing, for example, is that there's a lot of disagreement in the Republican caucus about exactly what to bargain for and what not to bargain for.
I want to bring on a caller now. We have Francisco with us in Sister Bay. Francisco, hi.
I'm here.
What do you think?
Okay, well, you know, this debate of this is so such a racist and hypocritical system that we have. Tracing back to the Anti-Chinese Exclusion Act. We don't want any Chinese, period. All right. We are only picking on the Mexicans and the Latins for the most part. It's 80 to 90% of the people. You know, whether they're the children or the ones who have been here illegally.
Francisco, I got you. We're just about out of time, and I want to let Hiroshi respond. Is there, do you think, a racial or a bias element in this, Hiroshi?
Well, I think the caller is right in the following sense, that ever since the early part of the 20th century, the American economy has relied on labor from south of the border, principally from Mexico, and it has kept them in the status where it's really hard to immigrate to this country to work unless you have a college degree, but the jobs are there, and there's been this kind of a informal system of making them illegal, but at the same time looking the other way, which then creates the 11 million people we have. And so I think it's a system that is set up to sort of illegalize, if you want to look at it that way, a lot of labor from Mexico and from Central America. And so in that sense, I think that it's kind of a unfortunately, this has been a pattern in American immigration history, is that we look for people to do the dirty and dangerous work, and then and that's a lot of how we got to 11 million people. That's why a comprehensive solution really has to figure out a way to allow people to immigrate to this country to work. But I think at the same time to provide safeguards for American workers, some of whom are displaced, but I think the majority of whom are actually helped because American businesses need labor at all skill levels.
Briefly, as we wrap up, we've seen these ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement raids on 7-Eleven stores targeting illegal workers and fining businesses, the franchise owners that employ illegal workers. Briefly, Hiroshi, are we going to see more focus on the employers?
It seems to be that. It seems to be that that's the case. I mean, that we see this in the most recent raids, but we've also saw it under President Obama, that is to go after the employers. So I think that this is part of the trend, but it's also part of a broadening and intensification of immigration enforcement you've seen in this administration that is actually quite different than under Obama. Under Obama, there was a lot of emphasis on enforcement, but it was of a different sort. Obama was much more focused on what was going on at the border and much more sympathetic to, for example, DACA recipients. President Trump seems to be intensifying enforcement, no matter where it takes place, interior or the border. And yet, at the same time, the border wall is kind of a signature initiative.
Hiroshi, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. He's a teacher and scholar of immigration and citizenship. He joined us to talk about DACA after a judge blocked President Trump's plans to end the program protecting almost 800,000 undocumented immigrants. And as we're seeing through the news today, Congress continues to work on a compromise on that and other immigration issues. On Tuesday, voters in far western Wisconsin will pick a new state senator after Republican Sheila Harsdorf joined the governor's cabinet in November. The special election for the 10th state Senate seat has been short and competitive. And Rich Kramer reports it's also being watched closely as a test of whether a Democratic wave is rising in Wisconsin.
The 10th Senate District runs from the city of Menominee along I-94 to River Falls, then hooks north to Burnett County. It's a blend of farmland and suburbs of the Twin Cities. For the first time in 17 years, the seat is wide open. The Republican candidate is Representative Adam Jarko of Balsam Lake. He's known for promoting private property rights in the face of local environmental regulations. At a candidate forum in New Richmond, Jarko said he's excited about Republican property tax and regulatory reforms luring businesses from Minnesota.
Every single employer out there is looking to hire. We're in an environment where wages are growing, where businesses are growing, where businesses are moving across the river to take advantage of some of the wonderful changes that we've had in Wisconsin.
The Democratic candidate, Patty Schachner of Somerset, is the St. Croix County Medical Examiner. Her campaign has painted her as a pro-Second Amendment bear-hunting public servant. At the forum, she said lawmakers need to do more for education and local economies.
41% of the people in New Richmond live in an income-restricted environment, which means they're struggling. They're working, but they're struggling. Those are the people I'm working for.
The battle over the 10th Senate seat has heated up in the final week of the campaign, and donations have poured in from within the district and beyond. Campaign finance reports show Jarko has raised nearly $270,000. Schachner has raised just more than $174,000. Outside groups are also heavily involved. Republicans have done well in the 10th Senate district, but there's a question of whether recent Democratic wins in Alabama and Virginia are signaling a wave of enthusiasm on the left. Lobbyist Jim Bender is a longtime Republican operative. He says Western Wisconsin is full of swing voters that could flip the seat.
I think that's the biggest question, is that group of people, that block of people that are willing to be nonpartisan and really try to push from the outside in, are they engaged in this race, or does this end up just being kind of your traditional Republican versus Democrat?
Former Democratic state senator turned lobbyist Gary Goyke was elected during a national wave in 1974. He says while the candidates may want to believe this race is a local affair, outside forces are at play.
There will be people voting in those elections who want to send a message that isn't about Patty or it isn't about Adam. It's about their feelings and about making a statement.
Rita Keating of Star Prairie is one of those people. As the New Richmond Forum let out, she said she supports Schachner on issues, but is also energized to oust Republicans after the election of President Donald Trump.
And I don't like the way the country's going right now. Sure. I was very complacent during the 2016 presidential election, and it will never happen again.
John Kraft of Roberts is a supporter of Adam Jarko. He doesn't think national politics will determine the outcome of this local race.
I'm sure the Democrats will see it that way. Should Patty get in, they would love nothing better than to flip that seat in the Senate, obviously. But because Governor Walker really put this thing on an accelerated time frame, I don't see that as really being a decent measure of what may happen in 2018.
This district has grown increasingly conservative over the years. President Trump won it by about 17 percentage points in 2016. Harsdorff won it by 26. Tuesday's election could gauge whether political winds are shifting and pushing a Democratic wave into November. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a guest makes the case that we can put an end to a wave of sexual harassment if we confront some fundamental issues of power in the workplace. 1968 was a pivotal year in American politics and society, and around the world for that matter. A historian tells us we can learn lessons here in 2018 by looking back 50 years. And on Food Friday, we'll find out how a splash of citrus can add some sweet, sweet sunshine to our wintertime cooking. Looking forward to getting some advice on cooking with the latest oranges, limes, whatever citrus we can find on the grocery store shelves. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 6, a recent blast of cold weather means it's a good time for ice fishing in a lot of the state. Kate's guest takes us on a tour of the Wisconsin tradition, and you can share your stories, questions, and favorite spots. That's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll learn about a trade dispute brought against the United States by Canada. Remember, you can listen to Wisconsin Public Radio in a lot of different ways. You can live stream at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app and listen on your phone. I'm Rob Ferret. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
I'm Monty.
And I'm Megan, and we're from Madison, Wisconsin.
And we donated both of our cars
to Wisconsin Public Radio. When we looked at the different places that we could donate the car, Wisconsin Public Radio was clearly the choice for us.
And we didn't really have any funds at the time to reimburse WPR for what the amount that we were listening to. And this was easier than I imagined it to be.
Donate your car through CarTalk's vehicle donation program. Go to WPR.org/support and thank you.
Where do you learn? In a classroom? At home? Wisconsin Public Television meets learners' needs wherever they are. We build on that sense of wonder you trust from PBS with engaging interactive resources and support for educators at all levels. And we partner with Wisconsin teachers to fit their needs. Best of all, it's free. Wisconsin Public Television is your place to grow through learning. To learn more, visit WPT.org.